Hello everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if like us you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host Josh.
And I'm your other host Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and write us a review.
But only if it's a good one.
Okay, everyone, before we carry on with this week's episode, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about something very, very exciting that we've been planning behind the scenes. In a couple of weeks, we will be launching our very own Patreon, and this will be called Murder, Mother and More. As a supporter of our Patreon, you will get 2 bonus episodes every single month. Now, these episodes will be a little shorter, a little bit more informal, and a little bit less polished than our main show. It's basically a great opportunity for you to get to know us more outside of the stories we tell on the main podcast. Now, you know we always love to keep things lighthearted here at Murder, Mother and Me. However, we will always stay respectful and serious when the story calls for it. And that will be no different on Murder, Mother and More. That means for a very small cost of £2.99 per month, you will get 2 episodes on the main show, plus 2 exclusive bonus episodes right here on Patreon. So all we ask is that when we launch our brand new Patreon, please, please, please show your support by subscribing to Murder, Mother and More, where you can expect more murder, more mother, and of course, more me. The links to our Patreon to subscribe will be in our Instagram bio. They will also be in the show notes for our episodes. And you can also visit www.patreon.com/murder, mother and more. We really hope to see you there and we can't wait to share more stories with you all.
Right, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the tragic case of Lacey Peterson. It's Christmas Eve 2002. A picture-perfect couple. A beautiful woman just weeks away from giving birth. A husband who says he came home to an empty house. But what happened to Lacey Peterson? And how did a man once seen as a loving husband become one of the most hated men in America? But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Lacey Denise Rocha was born on May 4, 1975, in Modesto, California. She was the youngest of 2 children, raised by her mother, Sharon Rocha, and his stepfather, Ron Gransky. Her parents divorced when she was very young, but despite this, Lacey grew up surrounded by love. She was a vibrant child, cheerful, outgoing, and full of life. Her natural warmth drew people to her, and she had a gift for making others feel welcome. From an early age, she took an interest in gardening, something she shared with her mother. She loved flowers, nature, and the beauty of the outdoors. By high school, she had blossomed into a bright, ambitious young woman. She was a cheerleader, popular but kind, the type of person who lifted others up rather than tearing them down. She had a tight-knit group of friends who adored her, and she dreamed of one day owning her own nursery, turning her love of plants into a career.
I'm assuming that's a plant nursery, not a child nursery.
Yeah, because she just said that she was interested in the outdoors and nature. And
I know, I was just going to say, well, why does she want to own a children's nursery if she loves plants?
Well, you weren't listening to the first bit, then.
The word nursery threw me.
Now, this is funny, right? Because in our dance school, you know, you're talking about a nursery for children. We did this song, and I can't remember what the song was, but I thought, oh, what can I do to keep them, like, all in the right place? Because they were all only, like, little kids. And we put them in plant pots. We dressed them up as flowers, and they stood in the plant pots. Jim, put that in, because someone will pinch that idea, okay? When she graduated, she enrolled at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo to study ornamental horticulture. She had plans, big ones. She wasn't just thinking about the present, she was building a future. And it was there, in college, that she met the man who would change everything.
You know, sometimes when people say, like, what they studied at college or university or something, I've never heard of half of this stuff. I've never even heard of ornamental horticulture. What is that?
Horticulture.
Is plants.
Is plants, yeah. But I guess ornamental horticulture is maybe a bit more landscaping and stuff like that, I think.
Why not just call it landscaping?
Well, maybe she studied horticulture in general, but then kind of specialised in ornamental horticulture.
But other than that, she seems like quite a nice girl, doesn't she?
Yeah, she seems like a popular, you know, just normal kind of everyday girl that just wanted, was a bit ambitious and wanted to build a future for herself. Scott Peterson was the kind of man who could walk into a room and make an impression. He was handsome, confident and charismatic, the type of person who always knew what to say to make people like him. Born on October the 24th, 1972 in San Diego, Scott grew up in a middle-class family. His parents, Lee and Jackie Peterson, ran a small business and they worked hard to provide for their children. Scott had been raised in an environment that valued appearances. Success, charm and social status mattered. He was a gifted golfer and for much of his youth he had dreams of going professional. But while he had talent, he didn't have the drive or discipline to make it a reality. Instead, he focused on business. He enrolled at Cal Poly, majoring in agricultural business, and it was there while working at a local restaurant that he met Lacey Rocha.
So is agricultural not like in the same realm of what she was doing as well, or is agricultural more like farming type of...
Yeah,
Am I completely wrong?
No, I think it all comes under the same umbrella, doesn't it? But I think the kind of agricultural business he was involved in was more like fertiliser. I think he was a fertiliser salesman. So, yeah, farmy kind of, you know...
I was just thinking maybe it's something that they potentially bonded over. Is that, you know, like similar interests?
I don't think she knew that when she met him because he was literally like a waiter in a restaurant that she went into. It's a bit strange though, isn't it, that they were both in the same field and probably when they did finally come on a date, that's probably did bond them a little bit, didn't it? Their relationship moved fast. Lacey, with her natural warmth and kindness, was drawn to Scott's easygoing nature. He was attentive, charming, and knew exactly how to make her feel special. For her, it was a fairy tale romance. To the outside world, they seemed like the perfect match, but there was something beneath the surface, something in Scott that Lacey never saw.
Well, so far, it just sounds like a million other stories that we've told, doesn't it?
It sounds like a perfect match, really.
Well, again, it's describing him as charming, charismatic, the same thing that we hear about all the psychopaths that we end up learning about throughout the stories. But I always find it suspicious when people care so much about their social status and what they look like to other people versus, you know, what's actually going on behind closed doors.
Yeah, and again, that is something in common with Ted Bundy, and he was like a prolific serial killer. We'll do that story one week, though. I mean, it's so well known, but it's really interesting. But he was another one. If you notice something else about this, they're saying that Scott never had the sort of determination and drive to be successful in, you know, like he was a good golfer and he just didn't have that drive to go for it. And you often find that as well because with Ted Bundy, he wanted to be a lawyer, but he just didn't have that determination to see it through. So maybe that's another trait of a psychopath. Who knows?
And it seems like she was just roped into this charismatic young man and he's made her believe that he's like the perfect partner for her.
Well, actually, something interesting about that is that when she went into the restaurant with her friends and she saw him, she wrote her phone number down on a piece of paper and got one of her friends to give it to him. And he never called her. He threw it in the bin. I think he thought she was just joking. But then she pursued that and went back and chased him again. So it's strange, isn't it, really? Because...
I was going to say, that's a bit uncommon, isn't it, for the woman to be chasing?
But she wasn't roped into it, you know what I mean? She actually actively pursued him, but then... It's that question of fate, isn't it? Is that what was meant? If she'd never done that, she would never have gone out with him and maybe met somebody else and had a happy life. Lacey and Scott married in 1997, and for a while, life seemed picture perfect. They moved to Modesto, a quieter suburban town, and settled into a comfortable routine. Lacey worked as a substitute teacher while Scott took a job as a fertilizer salesman. He was successful, earning a decent income that allowed them to live well. They bought a cosy single-story house in a nice neighbourhood. Lacey decorated it with care, filling it with warmth, plants and family photos. Actually, before this, they actually run like a restaurant type thing between them and it catered to students and things and they decorated it, you know. She was very good at that kind of thing, you know, bringing things, a vision to life kind of thing. And they ran that successfully between them and then they had enough of that and then I think this is when they started working. And I think they got more into a family lifestyle. By 2002, Lacey was pregnant with their first child, a little boy they planned to name Connor. She was ecstatic. She threw herself into preparing for motherhood, setting up the nursery, picking out baby clothes, and planning for the future. But while Lacey was envisioning a life with her growing family, Scott was drifting away. He wasn't excited about the baby. He wasn't affectionate. He wasn't present.
This is, so far to me, this is literally a carbon copy of the Shannon Watts. I know we covered that case quite a few episodes ago, but up to this point, it's exactly the same. They're like a picture-perfect couple. No one would think there was any problems. I think the only difference is it doesn't sound like Lacey and Scott are having financial issues, which we know Chris and Shannon were.
But it's just that, like, outward-facing image of a perfect couple. But really, he's just obviously... Well, we don't know what he's doing at the moment. But it said he's drifting away. He wasn't excited. He wasn't affectionate. He wasn't present. And that just is literally a carbon copy, isn't it, of Chris Watts?
Do you know what I noticed about those two cases, though? Another thing that is a commonality to them is that the effort is all coming from the woman. It's almost like the woman is planning the future and the fella's just along for the ride, really. It's like they're the alpha in the relationship, don't you think?
Just being told what to do.
I think it was more being told what to do because the man wasn't making the effort. Do you know what I mean? So somebody's got to lead and someone's got to follow. So I think that's the way it became, maybe. And also, she had an outgoing personality and so did Shanann Watts. So, and both of those two men were quiet. Scott and Chris were both on the quieter side.
Yeah, they were more reserved.
So you think, like, couples like that, do you know what I mean? Somebody's got to have to get up and go, haven't they?
Well, it says he was drifting away and he wasn't excited, and that's just not really what you want when you're pregnant with your first child, is it?
I believe at one point he said that he didn't want children at all, and Lacey came from a very sort of family environment, you know, she was very close to her family, and so I think earlier on, you know, he wasn't thrilled about having kids, but maybe just gave in to her because that's what she wanted. And then once he was sort of on board, he couldn't get off.
Well, I mean, that would explain why it's saying he wasn't excited about the baby then, if he'd never planned on having kids anyway.
Yeah. I think he pretended he was excited. And again, this is a little bit like Chris Watts, isn't it? So it was the same kind of scenario, really. December the 24th, 2002, was a crisp, chilly morning in Modesto, California. The streets were lined with homes decorated for the holidays, families were wrapping last-minute presents, and there was a quiet anticipation in the air, the kind that only comes on Christmas Eve. At 8 months pregnant, Lacey Peterson had been eagerly preparing for the holiday. She had spent the previous weeks decorating the house, setting up a Christmas tree, and making plans to host her family soon after the baby arrived. The nursery was nearly finished, painted in soft blues, with baby blankets folded neatly in anticipation of her son's arrival. I think the nursery was decorated in a nautical theme. This is kind of like an ongoing theme of that, it like weaves throughout the story, because on their first date, I think if I'm right, or one of the first dates, Scott decided to take Lacey sailing, which was his hobby, and she was really, really seasick. And so right from the beginning, you've got this, as I say, interwoven backstory of the sea, you know, which will come into it, it'll become more prevalent later on. And then even the baby's room was decorated sort of like in nautical fashion, you know, because they had like one of those life rings and everything on the wall. That morning, Lacey was supposed to bake, walk the dog, and then head to her mother's house later in the afternoon for Christmas Eve dinner. But something went terribly wrong. Scott Peterson would later tell police that he last saw Lacey that morning around 9:30 a.m. According to him, she was watching TV and planning to take their golden retriever, Mackenzie, for a walk in the neighbourhood park. He claimed he left home to go fishing at the Berkeley Marina, a strange decision for Christmas Eve, especially since it was a cold and overcast day. What happened to Lacey after that remains a mystery. At around 10:15 a.m, a neighbour found Mackenzie wandering the street alone. The dog was still wearing its leash, but Lacey was nowhere in sight. The neighbour, assuming the dog had simply gotten loose, put Mackenzie back in the Petersons' yard and thought nothing more of it. Hours passed. The sun began to set. Lacey never returned. By 5:15 p.m, her mother, Sharon Rocha, began to worry. Lacey had been excited for Christmas Eve dinner and she wasn't the type to disappear without calling. The family tried his cell phone. No answer. They called Scott. No sign of her. Scott returned home sometime after 5 p.m. He later claimed that when he arrived, the house was eerily quiet. Lacey's car was in the driveway, but she was nowhere to be found. Her purse, keys and sunglasses were inside the house, undisturbed. It was as if she had stepped out for a moment and never returned. As the minutes ticked by, the worry in Sharon's voice turned to panic. Something was wrong, very wrong. By nightfall, the search for Lacey Peterson had begun.
Well, the first thing that I pick up on straight away there is the purse and the keys and the sunglasses being left at home. I always say that,
don't
I? You
always say that, yeah? Like, yeah. A woman wouldn't go anywhere without
Well, I just
things.
Think, okay, yeah, fine. If you're on a dog walk, like, if Olivia's walking Teddy, she doesn't take a purse. So that's fine. It's the keys for me. Why would you go out and walk your dog and leave your house keys in the house? It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. So
not in that you know, I know there was probably a time when people would leave their houses unlocked and people would just wander in and blah, blah, blah. But I don't think 2002 was that kind of time where you would leave your keys at home and go and walk your dog with your front door left open.
No, I mean, how was she going to get back in for a start?
So that's the initial thing for me. Also, her car was found in the driveway. So she's obviously not gone anywhere far in her car or anything. So why is all her stuff still in the house? And why is the dog wandering around with the lead on?
I mean, you could think maybe at first that the dog had got away. You know, she's a pregnant woman, isn't she? If the dog pulls and she lets go of the leash, you know, the dog may come back.
Well, it sounds like that's what the neighbour thought as well, which is why it says the neighbour just put the dog back in the back garden.
Yeah, you wouldn't be alarmed. You wouldn't want the dog to be wandering around, so you'd just open the gate and let it in, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't really think, oh, where is she? You'd just think she was on her way back, wouldn't you? Or, you know, the dog had got out or something. But it's very strange, isn't it? I mean, she was planning to take the dog for a walk, but it's a cold and overcast day, you know, she's got no keys. You would think initially, I think, has she hurt herself or something, wouldn't you, that she'd fallen down somewhere maybe?
And, you know, it says they're trying to call her phone and there's no answer, and then they're trying to call Scott and he's saying he hasn't heard from her or anything.
Because she was so close with her family as well, the fact that she never called her mother, I think, and they were such a close family, you know, that would ring alarm bells right away, wouldn't it?
Well, we always say this, don't we? Like, you know your kids more than anyone as their mother. So for her mum to not hear from her between 10 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock at night, that's a considerable amount of time.
Yeah, you've got to remember as well, she was the only girl and she was close to her mother anyway. And the fact that she was pregnant as well.
I was just going to say, she's 8 months pregnant.
You would be in even more contact, really, wouldn't you? So it sounds like it's a regular thing. She does goes and walks the dog and everything. But I find it weird as well that, and I know this comes up in the story, you know, in other things that I've seen, but the fact that Scott decided on Christmas Eve to go out and do some sailing, you know?
Well, you know, it says Scott was going to do some fishing at Berkeley Marina. I mean, maybe it's just because we know the story, and is that weird? I don't even know. It's weird to me that you would leave your heavily pregnant wife at home on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, you wouldn't even go to Crime Con with me when Olivia was like a month off.
That's what I'm saying. So, like, that is weird. But maybe that's just me. Not everyone's the same. No, but I find it strange that he would leave.
I think it's weird. I think that's very strange.
And he would go fishing on his own as well.
As news of Lacey's disappearance spread, the community of Modesto came together. Flyers were printed, search parties formed, volunteers scoured the parks, rivers and back roads, calling her name and praying for a miracle. But one person wasn't acting the way people expected him to. Scott Peterson. From the start, his behaviour raised red flags. His emotions seemed rehearsed, too controlled, too detached. While Lacey's family and friends were visibly distraught, Scott was calm. Not the frantic, grieving husband everyone expected.
I'm going to say the same thing that I say every single episode, is that you can't judge someone's reaction to a situation because everyone's reaction is going to be different. Now, having said that, what I will say is the way he reacted is a bit bizarre to me because he completely avoided the media, didn't he? He didn't want to do any interviews. He didn't want to be on camera.
He didn't want to be on camera, and that will become clear why later on. He wasn't helpful. You know, he answered questions and stuff, but if your wife, who is 8 months pregnant with your first child, you know, a pregnant woman anyway is a worry, isn't it? Like, just going missing. You know, where's that connection to his wife and his child?
No, it just seemed very detached, didn't it? Like, it just seemed like he wasn't really that bothered whether she was found or not. And maybe he was under instruction from his lawyers or whatever to not speak to the media, to not do interviews, to not do stuff like that. But I wouldn't care. I couldn't care less if my lawyers told me not to or not. I'd be in front of every camera that would possibly listen.
I think it, even the emotional side, yeah, you may come across as a bit detached because, as you say, people handle emotional things differently. But I don't think surely you would look worried. I believe he was very composed, though, even as a child, you know. Like, that was his demeanour. So, to be fair, you've got to say that, you know, his demeanour was like that anyway. But I still think you would be on the camera and you'd be appealing for help, wouldn't you? Anything to get her found, really.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. I would, as, you know, as a husband, if my wife went missing, I'd do everything I possibly could.
I can't see any reason why they would tell him not to do that. I don't think he was instructed not to do it. I think he just didn't want to do it.
I mean, that's even more suspicious.
Suspicious, yeah. Mm. Then there were the inconsistencies in his story. Scott initially told investigators that he had been fishing that morning at the Berkeley Marina, but there was something off about his version of events. When asked what he had been fishing for, he hesitated. First he said striped bass, then he said sturgeon. His answers were vague, as if he hadn't planned them in advance. That's a question you wouldn't think they'd ask, would it? What were you fishing for?
Well, I think that if you're going fishing, usually, from my experience, when people go fishing, they know what type of fish are in that area that they're looking for.
Maybe. But then he could say if he was a new sort of angler and he wasn't used to doing it. Do you know what I mean? He may have just thought, I'll go out where it's deep and just fish, you know?
Well, then surely that would have been his answer then. Why is he giving these random answers?
That's what I mean. He's not been prepared for that, has he? I wouldn't think anyone has asked me that if I... Do you know if I...
No, you'd think they'd just ask, well, why did you go fishing in that area or whatever? Because I believe that this Berkeley Marina, it was not close to his house at all. It was a good couple of hours drive away, yeah. And I think the question has always been, why did he choose that specific area to go and fish in when there was fishing areas much closer to his house that he could have went to?
But did that not have something to do with the fact that it was deeper waters there? I'm guessing now, right, because I know a bit about the story and I can't quite remember at this moment, but when you go deeper out, there's like undercurrents and, you know, the way, I don't know anything about geography or oceanic sort of kind things, but
tectonic plates.
I know about tectonic plates because they cause earthquakes, but where currents, you know, like the Gulf of Mexico and things like that, I'm not saying that's there, but you know what I mean, it'll take it out to sea. They'll take things out to sea. You can see where I'm coming from here, can't you? So I don't need to spell it out, do I?
No. Well, you're not talking about the fishing.
No. Even more suspicious, he had only purchased a fishing license that morning just before heading out. It was as if he had suddenly decided on a whim to go fishing, a strange decision for someone whose wife was 8 months pregnant on Christmas Eve.
Didn't you say there was also something about the actual boat that he had as well?
Yeah, it came as a surprise to Lacey's family. I do know that he even had a boat. No one knew. And he had like a lock-up kind of place where he'd keep all his...
Yeah, like a shed kind of.
Yeah, where he worked a little bit from, you know, he probably did his orders there and stuff and probably was filled with fertiliser bags and things. And he kept it there, but, you know, they didn't even know he had a boat. And that's a bit weird, isn't it? That, why, you know, if I bought a boat, I'd be saying I bought a boat. You wouldn't just...
Did he even go fishing that much? Because if I had a boat and I went fishing regularly, everyone would know about it.
Yeah, he seems to be like an inexperienced fisherman. And then you think, well, why did he get that boat? And how long did he have that boat? What was the reason for him purchasing that boat then? It seems a bit convenient, doesn't it?
Well, and what was the reason that he only purchased the fishing license that morning? Do you think you need a specific license to fish in that specific area, and maybe that's why?
I think fishing licenses apply
everywhere.
To most places, yeah.
So then that's even more suspicious, isn't it? That he's bought it on the morning of. Because
yeah.
If you're a fisherman, you've got a license, haven't you? If you're regular.
I just think it's a bizarre thing to do, to wake up on Christmas Eve and go, I'll leave my wife who's 8 months pregnant. It's a busy day. It's Christmas Eve. It's freezing cold out. I'll go and get myself a fishing license and go miles away into this deep part of the ocean. And I'm not really sure what I'm going for, but I'll just go. You know, didn't know what he was catching.
I also believe that when the police searched this little lockup that he had where he stored this boat, there was a couple of suspicious things that they seen in there that they made note of. One of them being he had these homemade anchors, which were essentially just like a mould that he poured concrete into and used it as an anchor for the boat, which wouldn't be suspicious if he hadn't have made multiple of them. And he tried to say that he hadn't made multiple of them. He tried to say there was only one, and what they'd found was there was markings on the floor or something where he'd made multiple. A boat normally only has one anchor, especially a little fishing boat like that.
It probably had an anchor, didn't it? But let's face it, these aren't anchors, are they? These are weights, aren't they? Basically, when you make them out of concrete like that, you know, I found that a bit strange.
Well, and I'm sure if you're an avid fisher, there's probably a shop you can go to where you can just buy an anchor.
Maybe it was cheaper to do that, but why would you make so many, as you say? You know?
I think that was the police's question to him. Why is there multiple? And he tried to say there wasn't,
yeah, but
they
but
clearly
there was,
had
yeah.
found that there was more than one.
As the days passed, Scott's odd behaviour continued. He refused to take a polygraph test, claiming he was too stressed. He avoided the media and seemed more concerned with how he was being perceived than finding his wife. And then, weeks after Lacey went missing, he did something that left investigators stunned. He sold her car. Scott was moving on. He wasn't waiting for Lacey to return.
I mean, that's a bit mad, isn't it? That's selling the car. I wonder why he's done that.
I don't know. Does he need the money? I mean, you wouldn't do it anyway. I'm guessing it wasn't of any evidentiary value, so there would be no need to keep it. But you wouldn't do that with your wife missing. It's her car. That kind of tells you just that he knows she's not coming back.
I was just going to say, the only reason you would do that is if you knew she wasn't going to need it anymore. And also, it touches on the fact that, you know, he seemed more concerned with how he was being perceived, which kind of lines up with what we were saying before about, you know, these type of sociopaths, let's say. They're really more concerned with how people perceive them, isn't it? What they see rather than what's actually going on.
I think that's part of it, but I also think he was actually afraid to go on TV and everything for the reason that's coming up next. I think we're just going to get to it now. Then the biggest revelation of all came. A woman named Amber Fry stepped forward with shocking information. She had been dating Scott Peterson for weeks, completely unaware that he was married, let alone that his wife was missing. Scott had told her he was single. He had lied, telling her he had lost his wife months earlier, that this would be his first Christmas alone. Amber, realising the horrific truth, immediately contacted police. She agreed to help them, recording phone conversations with Scott. Those calls revealed a man who wasn't grieving. He was manipulative, calculated, and disturbingly nonchalant. While thousands searched for Lacey, Scott was whispering sweet nothings to his mistress. Oh.
That is just crazy, isn't it?
I really felt sorry for this girl, to be honest, because she was kind of painted as the mistress, but
She was completely unaware.
She really didn't know, and she'd not really had a good time herself. She had a child, and she'd retrained herself in a new career and things, and she was really just looking for someone to settle down with and to have like a good marriage with. That was the whole point. And her friend had suggested Scott to her because she'd met him on a night out, and she said, oh, you know, he'd be good, because obviously she didn't know what he was like. And then they got together, and she was just totally unaware about Lacey. Meanwhile, Lacey was at a Christmas party, a family Christmas party, on her own. And there's a photograph of her sitting in the chair, and she's really, like, you know, pregnant, you can see. And there's Scott on another photograph with Amber, and she's completely unaware of this as well. So whether Lacey knew about Amber, I really don't know.
I don't think she did, because wasn't there a conversation on a phone or something where he was saying he was in Paris?
Yes, yeah. He was, it was actually when Lacey had disappeared, they were doing like these rallies and things, and they were all going out to search for him. They were doing like vigils and things. And while that was going on at this vigil for his missing wife, he went off with his telephone somewhere in the crowd and phoned Amber. It was New Year's Eve, and was saying Happy New Year, and I'm in Paris. And there he is standing at this vigil, and she, you know, news to her, isn't it? So
now this is making a lot more sense, potentially, about why he didn't want to be so involved with the media stuff, because...
Well, he didn't want her to see, did he?
It kind of would have outed his whole secret life, basically, which ended up coming out anyway once she did see him on the news.
That's a bit of a dodgy scenario, that thing.
Can you imagine that, though? You've been going out with this guy, and then all of a sudden you see him on the news, and because his wife's missing. Because this wasn't just like a local thing, was it? It was like a nationwide search for him.
It started off like that, but then I think, obviously, you know what they always say, she was a white woman. You know, they always say that, don't they? And it is true to some extent, isn't it? It was pregnant.
And she was pregnant, yeah.
On Christmas Eve, you know, like it's a family time, so...
I think also the fact that this happened on Christmas Eve just adds that extra level of, like...
Pathos, yeah.
What's pathos?
You know, patheticness, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like it just... You just empathise so much with the family as well, don't you? Because Christmas is supposed to be such a happy family time. Yeah. And now you're looking for your daughter.
Yeah, and it's the birth of Jesus, isn't it? The next day, it's like a birth thing as well, you know, that's what Christmas is all about. And then there's this woman who's due to give birth, who goes missing, you know. I mean, I know it's all psychological and going deep, but it's true, isn't it?
Well, and I think, you know, this just kind of does not paint Scott in a good light whatsoever, does it?
Well, right away, it gives him a motive, doesn't it?
And this would kind of now make sense as to why Scott was seeming a bit disconnected, a bit distant, you know, not excited, not present, didn't want to have a child, because the whole time he was probably thinking, I just want to be with this other girl. And I'm going to bring it back to the Chris Watts thing again as well. It's an exact replica of the same thing.
It's very, very similar.
And it's always like grass is greener type of thing, isn't it? It's like they always want what they can't have.
I think the key element to this is the fact that there was children involved. I think both Chris and Scott weren't happy about... Shanann was pregnant, wasn't she? And Lacey was pregnant. And it was kind of as if it had been thrust onto them. You know, that was something they didn't really want. I don't know what the discussions were about all of this. Do you know what I mean? They'd been burdened with something they didn't want. That is the common denominator, I think.
I think also there's something really horrific about him telling Amber that his wife had died a couple of months earlier.
Didn't say that though, did he?
He just said he'd lost her.
He'd lost his wife, could be interpreted as gone apart. Well,
I interpreted it as that she died.
Well, you would think that, and I think that's what
He was quite clever with his words.
Yeah, he was clever with his words. Yeah. I think he just left it open, you know, to interpretation, really.
And then saying, you know, it's going to be his first Christmas alone. It's kind of playing on people's emotions, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trying to make her feel sorry for him. There's just something really, like, sadistic about that.
He's also kind of paving the way, isn't he, for if these questions come up later on, that he could address them sufficiently, you know, like, well, I did lose my wife, but it was not in the way that, yeah. you know. But
it's not in the way that she took it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, fair play to Amber for the moment she realised picking up the phone and ringing the police, because if she did know, why would she do that? If she did know about Lacey from the beginning.
No, she didn't know. She didn't have a clue.
I don't think she knew at all.
She definitely didn't know. I think she actually, if friend phoned her one day, or she... A friend said, is this your boyfriend that you're seeing, this Scott Peterson? And then she realised it was the same person, and that's when she phoned the police. You know, from Amber's point of view, you'd be absolutely livid, wouldn't you, for a start off?
Didn't she go on the news and do a live interview?
She did. She came on, and if you watch that, it's so... I felt so sorry for her. She looked white. Her hands were shaking. And she said, you know, Lacey's family have got my support and all my sympathy, you know? And I felt so sorry for her, because I think she did the right thing doing that, because... Immediately, people, I think, were on her side. You're always going to get the ones who weren't, but she knew nothing about it.
Well, so I think before she did that, she was quite a big target, really, wasn't she?
Yeah.
She was the reason that this whole thing had happened, when in reality, she had no clue what was going on.
No, I think it's a little bit different than the Chris and Shanann thing, because I think Nicole Kessinger, I think she knew that was Chris's mistress, wasn't it? I think she did know about... Well, she clearly knew about Shanann, because she'd looked her up online and everything. This was just total... surprise for Amber, wasn't it? Scott's facade was crumbling, and investigators now knew they weren't looking for a missing person, they were searching for a body. For months, Lacey's family held on to hope. Hope that she would be found. Hope that maybe, just maybe, she was still alive. But on April 13th, 2003, that hope was shattered. A couple walking along the San Francisco Bay shoreline made a horrifying discovery. The tiny, decomposed body of an infant washed up on the shore. The next day, another body was found nearby. This one was badly decomposed, unrecognisable, missing its head, hands and feet. DNA testing confirmed the worst. The baby was Connor Peterson. The other remains belonged to Lacey. Her body had been found in the exact location Scott claimed to have gone fishing that morning. It was no coincidence. The evidence was overwhelming.
How can he even argue with this? And again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. This place where he was supposedly went fishing was nowhere near his house. So why now would the body of his wife and his unborn son be washed up there?
You could say it was a coincidence, but I just don't believe in coincidence.
That's far
from
a coincidence.
Of all the places that body could get washed up.
It happens to be in the location that he's gone fishing. For what it seems, might be the first time ever. Which was at least a couple of hours away from his house.
I mean, there's a man who happens to be married to this woman who's now found decomposing on a beach, which ties in exactly where he went fishing with these homemade anchors.
In a boat that no one knew he owned, having just bought a fishing license on that day.
On Christmas Eve, and his wife was heavily pregnant, so...
None of it
even
adds
that
up.
Alone, just... And also, he's got a mistress on the side, and he's already said his wife had gone, so...
Well, none of it adds up in terms of Scott's side of the story, but everything adds up when you add it all together.
Yeah.
There's only one answer.
I'm adding two and two up here and coming up with four instead of five. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, you normally, you could say
Well,
that,
I think
but...
Scott's trying to add two and two and make 12.
On April the 18th, 2003, Scott Peterson was arrested. He had been in San Diego driving a car filled with everything needed for a quick escape. $15,000 in cash, camping gear, multiple cell phones, his brother's ID, and his hair and beard freshly dyed blonde. He had been planning to run. I nearly started laughing then, because that is just so well thought out, isn't it?
Well, the thing is as well, I believe he tried to tell police that he used to go to San Diego all the time to visit his brother, which maybe he did. However, if you're going to visit your brother in San Diego...
You don't dye your hair blonde, well, you?
And also, I think his brother had blonde hair, and I think he had blonde hair in his ID. And it says he has his brother's ID.
Ah, right.
So I think he was trying to...
Pass himself off as his brother,
but also...
Did his brother know about this?
Why do you need camping gear, multiple cell phones, $15,000 in cash if you're not planning on going somewhere?
I think the $15,000 in cash, his mother withdrew it for him, and she tried to say something like it got mixed up and she was transferred. There was some story about it, but really his mother, you know, Scott was the golden child in that family, and I think his mother would have done anything to cover up for him.
Point being, if you're going to visit your brother, you don't need all this extra stuff, do you? Like, I mean, camping gear. Are you going to camp in his back garden?
What was he expecting to do?
I don't know. So, again, it's just like, it's more things that are adding up on Scott, isn't it?
Well, it's making him look guilty as hell, isn't it? That he's trying to escape. He said he wasn't, but he definitely was.
But also, with all the heat on him as well, I mean, the bodies have just been found. You know, the mistress is, well, not the mistress, but you know what I mean. The affair that he's having has come out. Why would you even try and think that you could get away with running away?
The trial that followed was one of the most sensational in modern history. The evidence against Scott was circumstantial, but damning. The recorded phone calls, the lies, the fact that Lacey's body had been dumped in the very place Scott claimed to have gone fishing. On November 12, 2004, the jury reached a verdict. Scott Peterson was found guilty of first-degree murder for Lacey's death and second-degree murder for Connor's. A month later, he was sentenced to death. For years, Scott remained on death row. Then, in 2020, his death sentence was overturned due to errors in jury selection. His conviction, however, remained. He is still serving life in prison, stripped of the life he once knew.
We've said it so many times about circumstantial evidence in so many cases that we've covered recently, but...
I think there comes a point, though, doesn't there, when the circumstantial evidence adds up so much that you really can't ignore it.
That's what I mean. I do find it quite baffling that in this case, though, there wasn't one piece of concrete evidence against him.
Was that a joke, Josh? Concrete
yeah,
evidence?
Yeah, no, I didn't mean that, sorry. No pun intended. But you know what I mean? There was no solid evidence that was like...
That tied him to
the smoking gun, as they say. There was no, yeah, like...
They didn't find a murder weapon.
Yeah, they didn't find a murder weapon. They didn't find, like, hair. They didn't find blood. They didn't find anything. So I've always thought, I wonder what, actually happened.
I know, I'm thinking that myself now, because actually the dog being on the loose...
I was going to say that.
...does not mean that Lacey actually went out either. Although there were some sightings of people who thought it was her, but then... It could have just been confusion. They couldn't remember the days. Do you know what I mean? It could have been a different day because that was their routine to take the dog for a walk. But if just let's just say Scott killed Lacey at home. He could have loaded her into the car, couldn't he? Put the leash on the dog and let the dog out running. Or took the dog in the car, dropped it off where he normally does, knowing it was going to find its way back home. Surely they're kind of things that you would think of to do if you were going to try and... make it look as if she'd gone out for a walk. So that doesn't wash with me that she actually even went out.
Well, yeah, I think...
In fact, I don't think she did go out.
No, I don't either. I think I think he has gone out at 9:30 in the morning, but not to go fishing. I think he's thought, how can I get this body as far away from home as possible, yeah, with what he may have thought in that moment is a valid reason, which was him going fishing. And I think the dog is a red herring.
Yeah, I think if the dog was found in the house, it would... from his point of view, would indicate that she never left the house, and he was trying to make it look as if she'd left the house, and it bought him time, didn't it, as well? So Lacey was already dead that morning, Christmas Eve morning, and that's why he acquired this fishing license at the last minute. But do you think he planned this, as in, maybe not planned it for Christmas Eve, but why would he be making all these weights and things in advance? He couldn't do that morning.
I think he knew what he was going to do eventually. Maybe he didn't know he was going to do it at that exact time, but I think his idea was always to get rid of her, and I think, you know,
I think something's happened on Christmas Eve, and who knows, maybe she found out about Amber.
I was just gonna say, I think this Amber Fry situation does play a massive part in this story as to why he ended up killing her, and there's no doubt in my mind that he did kill her.
And I'm gonna say it again, the Shanann Watts and Chris Watts case is very similar. He had said that he was planning to do that before, and the opportunity that night, because they argued, just presented itself. He hadn't planned on that night, but he always knew he was going to do it. And this is a very similar thing, I think.
It sounds like the pregnancy is what's really tipped him over the edge. And I think to kill a woman that is almost full term of pregnancy, never mind just a woman, but your wife, you know that if you kill her, you're killing your unborn child as well. So the only thing I can think of
is that he wanted
to get rid of that child. He didn't want the child.
I don't think he wanted any of it. I think he wanted to go and to start a new family. Just erase all that, you know. It's weird, really, because Amber already had a child, though. So, but it was she was only a young child, but she was kind of like a grown-up child, you know what I mean? It wasn't a baby. I don't know. I really can't explain it, but...
But there's no doubt in our mind that he is the one that done it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that is the death penalty was commuted to life in prison, I think. I mean, I don't know how long they keep them on death row for, but...
Well, some of them spend the rest of their life on death row, don't they? But I always just think of, you know, the family and how they must feel when your daughter's killer has been sentenced to death and now all of a sudden it's overturned, you know?
The sad thing about it is, I think, that Lacey's family were completely behind him at first. Her brother, everybody.
But why wouldn't you be, though? It's her husband.
They said at the beginning, no, it's no way, it's Scott, you know? And then I think once they found out about Amber, that's when it turned, because they knew then. Because obviously, you found that out. What are you going to think?
I think also the worst part of this for me is he's never actually admitted anything. He's still
maintaining his
image. Yeah, he still maintains his innocence.
His family man image.
To this day, even though he's serving life in prison.
But you know how important image was to him? And it's weird, really, because it was the same again with Chris Watts. They didn't want people to think they were this monster that could do this. They wanted to maintain this family man image, didn't they? Right till the end, sort of. Another thing is when the bodies were washed up, you know, the baby's body was washed up first and the baby's body wasn't as decomposed, because that's the saddest thing of all, I think, that even right up until the last minute when she couldn't do anything about it, Lacey's body protected that baby. And when she couldn't do any more, the baby was washed ashore, do you know what I mean? But it had been actually protected by her all that time, and yet she was so badly decomposed. Imagine what that must be like for her family. She actually had sea life living inside her body. It had been in the water for like 4 months, hadn't it, by this point, roughly. And imagine your daughter's body being washed up, or your sister's body, or whatever, with no head, no legs, or it was just a torso, basically. And yet the baby was intact, you know? That is so sad. And I can't remember if in the courtroom he couldn't look at the photographs or...
I think the saddest part is that she was a couple of weeks away from giving birth.
And that's what she wanted. And again, that's what I meant to say before with the Chris Watts thing. Why don't they ever just walk away and get a divorce then? Why is there the need to do this? And again, I come back to image. They'd rather be a murderer than lose this image, you know?
Well, I think, honestly, they don't ever expect to get caught. I think they genuinely believe that that is a better option, and that they're not going to get caught, than to actually just get a divorce.
In what world do you think, though, you are going to get away with that when police investigate her? The two of them, though, you know, both...
People are Delulu.
Yeah, you're right. But the two of them, both Scott and Chris, are really doting mothers, you know. And in their family, they were like the golden child, like I said before. It was like they could do no wrong, you know. So did that kind of bolster that image of themselves to themselves? In that they actually believed their own hype, you know what I mean? Lacey should have been preparing for motherhood. She should have been holding her newborn son in her arms, celebrating Christmas with her family. Instead, she became another tragic name in the world of true crime. A woman whose life was stolen by the very man who had promised to love and protect her. Scott Peterson could have chosen another path. Divorce, honesty, anything but murder. Instead, he chose to destroy two lives, leaving behind a trail of heartbreak and devastation. A mother, a child, a future that was never meant to be. But actually, it wasn't just two lives, was it? It was his own life as well, but it was his family's life and her family's life.
Well, it's all the families, isn't it? Everyone's going to be affected by it.
People who believed and trusted in him.
Also, there's a really good documentary about this case on Netflix. It's called American Murder. The case of Lacey Peterson, something like that. If you've never watched it, go and watch it on Netflix, because it is really, it's equally as interesting as it is heartbreaking. So if you are interested in the story, go and give that a watch.
It just always makes me think that if she'd never met him, is it fate? You know, I believe in fate. She was meant to meet him that day for whatever reason, but it's that thing, isn't it? Turn a different corner, you know, walk a different way.
But you could say that about any true crime case, couldn't
you? Well, anything, yeah. But I always think of that with every case. But you know, if she'd not gone into that restaurant. But if you believe in fate, these things all lead to, you know, what, one road, really.
I just think, like, you know, this happened on Christmas Eve. She was 8 months heavily pregnant. They were about to start a family. It's just... Yeah, it's just heartbreaking, isn't it? The circumstances around it are just awful as well.
Because it could have been so different.
If he'd have just been honest and said, listen, I'm having an affair, I know you're pregnant, but this is not for me anymore, see you later. That's it. That's all he needed to do. Yeah, that's going to be heartbreaking as well. But you don't have to take someone's life and take your child's life with it as well.
According to Scott, though, he's had that discussion with Lacey that he told her about Amber. But I don't know whether the kind of person that Lacey was... Her family said there's no way she would have accepted that. But he was saying she was okay with it, but I don't think she was, do you? And maybe that's what caused the argument at the end.
What a sad case.
Very sad one. they're all sad in their own way, aren't they? But I think when it's got a child involved and a pregnant woman involved, you know, it's
well, especially when, worse. When you've got your own kids as well, it hits home a little bit more, doesn't it, than normal?
You always identify with certain cases, don't you? You know, and if you've got like a young child, you'll identify with it, or if you're a pregnant woman, you'll identify with it.
Well, I think it's safe to say that Scott Peterson is where he deserves to be, and I don't think he will ever get out, no matter how many times he appeals or
I think
anything
he's tried for a retrial anyway, but that's overwhelming evidence to me.
Right, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time,
don't do the crime.